Thank you for joining us for Food and Stuff. My name is Gretchen Miller. We're going to start off today with a recipe from smittenkitchen.com for falafel. I love falafel. I hope you do too. Until recently, if you'd asked me if I ever wanted to make falafel at home, I'd have said, sure, one day, but what I meant was, nah, why bother? I was certain that falafel was fussy to make and had a long ingredient list. Probably related in some way to a fritter, meaning that it was bound with eggs and flour and probably had breading on it too, all pesky steps, and this is even before you get to the peskiest of all, defrying them. I figured that it's one of those things that there are as many recipes for as there are people who make it. Thus, whatever I came up with would be wrong by default. Too firm or too soft, with chickpeas instead of favas or vice versa, no matter what. But this isn't the whole truth. The fact is that below 14th Street, there are two locations, each of Tayim and Mamoun's. Every time I even distantly considered whether I needed a homemade falafel recipe in my life, I knew I could get a perfectly executed sandwich in my hands before I even wrote out a grocery list. Hey, I'm not proud of this. I pride myself on being a curious person in the realm of cooking, so it's pretty pathetic that I had falafel all worked up in my head as this highly complex thing and never once, you know, read a few recipes. Had I, I'd have learned many extremely cool things about falafel, such as the fact that while you do need to start with dried chickpeas, you don't even have to cook them, or not in the classic long simmering way to make it. You soak them overnight in cold water, grind them up with seasoning and herbs, and pack them into spoonfuls, fry them in less than an inch of oil in merely a few minutes, and that's it. There's no egg, there's no breading, it's vegan, it's gluten-free, it's dirt cheap, and it's easy, I mean criminally easy to make, and I had to do it immediately. In real life, however, I waited until the first night of Hanukkah for two reasons. One, fried food is basically the only rule of the holiday, and two, a family member has recently gone vegan, and I weirdly love the challenge of trying new menus. Obviously, the meal ended with this cake, and there's a link at smittenkitchen.com. Making falafel for 10 people was so easy, I had spare time to kill, and so I decided to make pita bread, too. Okay, I'm a little nuts, but the fact is that 90% of store-bought pita is dry and terrible, and even the worst homemade pita, the couple that refused to puff or puff erratically, as you see here, is still delicious. Here's the recipe for falafel. This makes 19 falafel fritters for 4 to 6 pita sandwiches. Takes 30 minutes plus an overnight and a 30-minute rest. I know many of us dread frying foods, but for whatever it's worth, making falafel involves none of the headaches that other fried foods do. You don't need a lot of oil. 3/4 depth is fine. You don't need to stress over anything burning on the outside while still being unsafe to eat. Fried chicken, I'm looking at you. In the middle. You don't need an entire roll of paper towels and every counter in your home to drain the falafel because they weirdly don't pick up that much oil at all. In fact, I measured the oil I used before and after making falafel and found that each ball picked up a scant 1/2 teaspoon of oil. You put 3 to 4 in a pita, they are shockingly unheavy and ungreasy. This makes 19 pieces of falafel about 1.5 inches in diameter, using a 1.5 tablespoon cookie scoop to measure. I estimate 3 to 4 for each medium-large pita sandwich portion to make 4 to 6 total, but we preferred only 3 in each. This recipe scales easily. I'd recommend doubling it for a crowd, or even just to stock your freezer for a future falafel night. You'll need 1/2 pound of dried chickpeas, 1/2 of a large onion, roughly chopped, or 1 cup chopped scallions, 2 to 4 garlic cloves, peeled. I use 4, but adjust to your tastes. 1/4 cup of finely chopped fresh parsley, if you're measuring, or a big handful. 1/4 cup of finely chopped fresh cilantro, and if you're measuring, or a big handful. 1 teaspoon of fine sea salt, or 2 teaspoons of kosher salt, plus more to taste. 1/2 to 1 teaspoon of hot red pepper flakes, or mild ones, such as Urfa Biber or Aleppo. 1 teaspoon of ground cumin, and peanut or vegetable oil for frying. To serve, you need pitas, tahini sauce, tomato cucumber salad, harissa, either homemade or store-bought, or another hot sauce, and any pickled vegetables that you wish, such as cucumbers, red onion, or mango, also known as amba. As far as the night before, you're going to place the chickpeas in a large bowl and add enough water to cover them by a few inches. I like to put 1 tablespoon of kosher salt per pound of chickpeas in this water too. It will not toughen the beans or slow down their cooking time. It simply seasons them, and let the chickpeas soak overnight. An hour or so before you'd like to eat the falafel, drain the chickpeas well. In the bowl of a food processor or a really strong blender, place the onion, garlic, and herbs and pulse the machine until they're coarsely pulsed. Add the drained chickpeas, salt, and spices and process until blended to a fine chop but not pureed. You are looking for a texture like cooked couscous plus some slightly larger bits throughout. You should be able to pinch it together into a shape that holds. Transfer the chickpea mixture to a bowl, cover with plastic, and place in the refrigerator for a few hours if you have it. But I find even 30 minutes is helpful in getting the mixture to thicken and hold the shape better. This is when I like to get everything else ready. To shape the falafel, you're going to form the chickpea mixture into walnut-sized balls. You could use a falafel scoop if you have one, tablespoon measuring spoon, or even a cookie scoop, as I did. The most important thing is that you press it into the scoop tightly to compress the ingredients, and then gently roll it in the palm of your hands to form a ball, repeating with the remaining chickpea mixture. If you're like me, you imagine you can just do this as you add them to the pan, but they cook so quickly, you'll be happy to not have to multitask, trust me. To cook the falafel, you're going to heat 3/4 to 1 inch of oil in a medium-large frying pan to 375 degrees Fahrenheit. Fry about 6 falafel fritters at a time, turning them over once they're a nice toasty brown underneath, and removing them once the second half has the same color. This took me about 3 minutes per batch. Drain on paper towels and repeat with the remaining fritters. You don't have a thermometer? Well, 375 degrees is very, very hot. It takes my frying pan of oil on high heat about 5 minutes to reach this temperature. You can also test a small ball. If it cooks in about 3 minutes, it's probably about the right temperature. As far as serving, I like to split open a pita and start with a little tahini sauce and a spoonful of salad at the bottom before adding 3 to 4 falafel fritters. Stuff and finish with a more generous scoop of tomato cucumber salad, more tahini sauce, a hot sauce of your choice, and pickles if you wish. Here are some extended notes. To make the tahini sauce, I have trouble nailing down precise measurements for tahini sauce because you really want it to taste, and tahinis vary between brands. But it's roughly this for the amount of falafel, about 1/2 cup of well-stirred tahini and 1 clove of garlic, minced or finely grated, plus the juice of 1/2 lemon, plus more to taste, plus salt to taste, plus water as needed to thin tahini into a sauce. It's not strange to need at least as much water as you do tahini to keep it loose and spoonable, but I add it 1 tablespoon at a time, whisking to combine and tasting along the way. Some falafel recipes contain flour to make it heavier and more firm. Some contain baking powder for fluff, but after making a batch with both, I found that I preferred the purest route with neither. Should you wish to add flour, add 1 tablespoon at a time, frying off a ball after each addition until you get the texture that you wish, not going further than 4 tablespoons or it will be excessively leaden. To add baking powder, you could use 1 to 1.5 teaspoons for the whole recipe below, but personally I found the change in fluffiness nominal and the texture without it not lacking at all. I'd forgotten how easy it is to make pita bread and I proceeded to make it 4 more times in 2 weeks, sometimes for falafel and other times just to go with a really great soup or stew. The recipe was fine as written, but I've cleaned it up and simplified it because it's easier than I made it sound. They rewarm well and can be kept warm in a basket lined with a napkin or cloth towel for a while. You know that you want to have them. You guys, I'm that weird home cook that finds chopping things cathartic, which is why in the 10 years since my mother-in-law bought me one of these to make the perfect salad Oliver and vegetable soups, I hadn't once used it. Well, I looked at the great mass of cucumbers and tomatoes that I wanted to chop, and I decided that there was no time like the present to give it a spin. I bashed up the tomatoes a bit, but I regret nothing. All right, we're going to jump over to a recipe from The Blind Kitchen. This one for AAA salad. Why is it called the AAA salad? Because the ingredients start with the letter A. Apples, arugula, avocado, and almonds. But who's counting all of the ingredients that begin with A? This yields two dinner side salads or four side salads. Note, each of the ingredients in this salad can be exchanged for others if you do not like them or are allergic to them. Dress it with a dressing of your choice. The ingredients for this salad are mild in taste. Your choice of dressing is what brings them to a new level. One good choice is the creamy lemon basil dressing, and we might get to that recipe. Recipe tip, if you plan to use the creamy lemon basil dressing for the salad, make it first so that the ingredients have time to meld. Here's the AAA salad ingredients. You'll need 4 ounces of arugula, 4 ounces of baby spinach, 4 ounces of romaine or another crispy lettuce or cabbage of your choice, 1 apple of your choice, tart or sweet, 1 ripe avocado, 16 cherry or grape tomatoes, 8 teaspoons of slivered almonds, and salt and ground black pepper to taste. First, you're going to toast the slivered almonds so that they have time to cool while you make the rest of the salad. Place 8 teaspoons of raw slivered almonds in a dry pan and cook for 5 to 8 minutes over medium heat until they smell toasted, agitating them every 30 seconds or so that they do not burn, and set them aside to cool. Here's a recipe tip. You're going to smell the almonds while they are still raw, so you will be able to differentiate the smell of raw versus toasted almonds. And then the TBK tools, dry measure spoons and a long wood spoon. Next, step number 2, you're going to clean and destem 4 ounces of arugula, 4 ounces of raw spinach, and 4 ounces of romaine lettuce. Cut them into bite-sized pieces and set them aside in a strainer so that they can drain well. Recipe tip, you're going to use kitchen scissors to easily cut the larger leaves. Your fingers are closer to the action and it's easy to know when they are the correct size. That is a good tip. TBK tools, a slicing bowl, a cut glove, and a talking scale. For a recipe tip, the apple and the avocado will start to break down and take on an unpleasant appearance, texture, and taste once they are cut. Save them for the very last step when you are ready to serve the salad. Step 3, you're going to halve or quarter 16 cherry or grape tomatoes and then set aside. Step number 4 is to remove the core of an apple of your choice and peel if desired. Thinly slice the apples and further cut them into bite-sized pieces. Store covered in water to keep them from turning brown until you're ready to use. The recipe tip, since many ingredients in a salad are green in color, choosing a red apple and not peeling it will add another attractive color to the salad mix. The TBK tools here are a slicing guide, peeler, and a food corer. Step 4, peel and thinly slice or cube a ripe avocado. There's a TBK tool, an avocado tool, a slicing guide, and a cut glove. Step 5, just before serving, combine all of the ingredients and mix well. Add salad dressing or allow people to add their own. And step 6, season with salt and pepper. Step 7, sprinkle the salad with toasted slivered almonds and enjoy. So we're going to go back to that recipe for the creamy lemon basil dressing. That sounds pretty yummy. Let's find out what's in there. The sweetness of the basil and the tartness of the lemon come together in this delicious and creamy dressing. Just add all ingredients to a blender or a food processor, mix well, and refrigerate until ready to use. This is going to yield 12 ounces of dressing, which is 10 to 14 servings. Note, you want to refrigerate for at least 2 hours after blending to allow the flavors to blend. It can also be made for up to 3 days before use. Add the dressing to the salad just before serving. You'll need 1/2 cup of sour cream, 1/2 cup of mayonnaise, 1/2 cup of chopped scallions, 1/2 cup of packed chopped fresh basil with the stems removed, 2 tablespoons of freshly squeezed lemon juice, 1 clove of minced or grated garlic, 1 teaspoon salt, 1/2 teaspoon of freshly ground black pepper. You're going to prepare the fresh produce and the dry ingredients first before measuring the more sticky, wet ingredients. You can prepare your work area by getting out your work tray, scraps bowl, sharps baskets, apron, towel clips, clean cloth, and run a few inches of soapy water. You're going to wash a lemon and squeeze out 2 tablespoons of lemon juice. Add to a blender. You can use your mesh strainer and wet measure spoons to strain and measure the juice. Remove the stems from 1 cup of fresh basil leaves and cut the leaves into small pieces. This should produce a 1/2 cup of tightly packed basil pieces. Add to the blender. TBK tip, use kitchen shears to remove the stems and cut them into small pieces. You can use your cut glove, dry measure cups, and bench scraper to cut scallions into 1/2 inch pieces using both white and green parts to produce 1/2 cup, and then add those to the blender. Use your cut glove, mini box grater, and bowl scraper to grate 1 large clove of garlic and then add to the blender. TBK tip, grate the garlic into a small bowl. The pieces will be very small and sticky, and the small dish will help to contain them. You can use your salt cellar and dry measure spoons. Add 1 teaspoon of salt to the blender. Add 1/2 teaspoon of ground pepper to the blender. Add 1/2 cup of sour cream to the blender. And add 1/2 cup of the mayonnaise to the blender. Blend for 2 minutes or so and check to make sure the mixture is smooth with no chunks. Blend until smooth. TBK tip, if you are having problems getting it all smooth, strain the mixture using the straining system, which is a cheesecloth bag and a wide mouth funnel and canning jar with lid. Cover and refrigerate to allow the flavors to blend and then enjoy. Next recipe, we're going to do from also the Blind Kitchen for caramelized apple pie. This caramel-based apple pie starts on the stovetop and is deliciously spiced. It's a spin-off from the humble apple pie that Christine Ha made on MasterChef. This is a link to the video showing Gordon Ramsay critiquing the pie. He made her cry, but he highly praised the pie. This is going to yield 1 9-inch pie. Recipe tip, keep the pie dough chilled as much as possible for a flakier result. Ingredients, you'll need 2 9-inch pie crusts. They can be store-bought or use the Blind Kitchen recipe for basic pie dough, the flakiest, and there is a link at theblindkitchen.com. Our crust is much like Christine Ha's version, but it's the recipe that I learned in culinary school. You're going to need 5 to 6 cups of Granny Smith apples, peeled, cored, and thinly sliced. This will be 6 to 8 apples, depending on the size. 1/2 cup or 4 ounces of unsalted butter, 1/2 cup flour, 2 tablespoons of apple juice, 2 tablespoons of apple brandy. Note, if you do not want to add alcohol, you can substitute 2 additional tablespoons of apple juice. 2 tablespoons of half and half or heavy cream, 1 tablespoon of vanilla extract, 1/2 cup of brown sugar, 1/2 cup of white sugar, 1 teaspoon of cinnamon, 1/4 teaspoon of nutmeg, 1/8 teaspoon of ground cloves, 1/2 teaspoon of salt, 2 tablespoons of cornstarch, and 1 egg. First, you're going to prepare your work area. You want to prepare the spice blend and measure out the wet ingredients first. The stovetop sauce comes together quickly. So step one, in a small dish, you're going to combine the following spices. 1 teaspoon of cinnamon, 1/4 teaspoon of nutmeg, 1/8 teaspoon of ground cloves, and 1/2 teaspoon of salt. Set the spice mixture aside. Freshly ground spices are much stronger than ground versions that lose their potency over time. The mini box grater tool and the cut glove are the perfect tools to grind fresh cinnamon, nutmeg, and cloves. Step two, you're going to combine the following wet ingredients. It's fine to pre-measure and combine these wet ingredients as they will be added to the pan at the same time. And also the wet measure cups and the wet measure spoons are the perfect tools to allow people with vision loss to measure wet ingredients quickly, accurately, and without waste. You'll need 2 tablespoons of apple juice, 2 tablespoons of apple brandy, and again, if you don't want to use the alcohol, you can substitute 2 additional tablespoons of just apple juice, and then 2 tablespoons of half and half or heavy cream, and 1 tablespoon of vanilla extract. We're going to set the wet mixture aside. Next, you're going to prepare the apples. Once the apples are peeled, it's important to keep them under water as exposure of the fruit to air will cause them to start to break down and take on an unpleasant color and taste. You're going to peel and cut the apples into similar bite-sized pieces and put in a bowl, cover with water, and set aside. The food corer tool from the Blind Kitchen cuts each apple into 12 wedges, which are the perfect size for an apple pie. I use the food corer to cut the apples into sections before I peel them. This way I can examine each section as I peel it and have the opportunity to peel away any of the rough core portions that might have come off with a section. And then I cut each wedge in half for perfect bite-sized pieces. Recipe tip, the palm peeler and the cut glove tools make this step easy and safe. Next, step four, you're going to make a roux. In a pan that is large enough to hold the apple pieces, melt 4 tablespoons of unsalted butter. The butter slicer is a handy tool that allows you to pre-cut your butter into similar size pats that you can store in your refrigerator to just reach in and grab as many as you need for a recipe. For this recipe, you need 12 pats. You're going to melt the butter under the lowest heat possible as you want to hear it just lightly sizzle. The dairy sugars in the butter can easily burn and you want the butter to just sizzle slightly. And when the butter's melted, you can allow it to sizzle for about 60 seconds more while moving the melted butter around the pan. Step 5, combine flour and butter. Add 1/2 cup of flour to the pan and use a whisk to combine the flour and the butter. Cook over low heat for about 2 minutes, whisking constantly. The mixture should resemble wet sand. Step 6, you're going to add in the wet ingredients. Add in the liquid mixture of the apple juice, the apple brandy if you're using it, vanilla extract, and half and half. Raise the heat slightly and whisk constantly until the mixture comes to a boil. Reduce the heat to a low simmer. Step 7, you're going to add the spice blend. Add in the spice blend of cinnamon, nutmegs, and cloves, and salt, and you're going to whisk until combined. Next, you're going to add the cornstarch. Add 2 tablespoons of cornstarch and whisk for another minute or two. The cornstarch will help to thicken the caramel liquid and also to absorb the juices of the apples that are released as they cook. Step 9, you're going to add sugars. Add 1/2 cup of brown sugar and 1/2 cup of white sugar and stir to combine. Next, you're going to add the apples. Drain the apples and add to the pan. Save the bowl to hold the cooling apples. And then cook until the apples just start to soften. Recipe tip, take care not to overcook the apples at this point. They should still have a slight crunch in the center. They will continue to cook in the oven, and you don't want to reduce them to an applesauce consistency. Step 11, you're going to set the apple mixture to cool. Place the apple mixture into a bowl to stop the cooking process and allow it to cool while you prepare the pie crust. You're going to preheat the oven to 425 degrees And check the oven rack level before you turn on the oven. The racks are much easier to adjust when the oven is cold. For this recipe, the pie should be cooked in the center of the oven. Next, you're going to put the bottom crust in the pie pan. Place one pie crust in the bottom of a 9-inch pie pan. If you are using a bake under the pie server, place it under the bottom crust first. I like stainless steel pie pans because they conduct heat evenly. Glass and ceramic pie pans can be made of various materials and can be less predictable. Also, the standard stainless steel pans are the perfect size and shape to use the bake under the pie server. When preparing the pie dough, I use the large dough and pastry work tray. Its generous size and raised edges make it an ideal place to roll out your dough without getting flour all over the counter. It makes cleanup much easier. I use the adjustable rolling pin in the pie dough bag to ensure that the dough is the thickness that I desire and the perfect shape. And then I like to place the apples in a mound in the center of the pan for an attractive presentation, even distribution as the apples cook. If you're using the pie crust stencil to make the steam holes, use it before you place the top crust onto the pie, and use the pie dough bag to transfer the crust to the top of the pie. And then crimp the edges to seal the top and bottom crust together. Use the crust crimper tool to seal the edges easily and attractively. Lightly whisk the egg and use a pastry brush to put an egg wash on the top crust and the crust edges. Sprinkle the pie with a light dusting of granulated sugar. Cut evenly, 6 evenly spaced narrow slits in the top of the crust. You can skip this step if you use the pie crust stencil in step 15. You're going to use the pie marker and divider to evenly cut evenly spaced steam slits in the top crust of the pie. And then protect the edges of pie crust with foil or a pie crust protector. You can get a pie crust protector at the Blind Kitchen store. It's adjustable and it works nicely for a 9-inch pie. You're going to place the pie on a rack in the center of the oven and cook for 15 minutes. Do not open the oven, but reduce the heat to 350 degrees and cook for another 20 minutes. Use the heat gloves to pull the oven rack out halfway so you do not need to put your forearms in the oven, only your fingertips to pull the rack out and push it back in. It's very easy to break off pieces of the crust edges when putting the pie in and out of the oven with the thickness of many oven mitts or gloves. I place the pie on a baking sheet with raised edges so that my gloved hands will come in contact only with the baking sheet and the crust remains safely out of reach. The raised sides of the baking sheet help to keep the pie on the sheet as the pie is removed. The pie can easily slide off of a flat baking sheet. You're going to remove the protector and cook the pie for another 10 to 15 minutes until it's done to the desired doneness and allow the pie to cool for at least 10 minutes. And then cut and serve as desired. Thank you for joining us for Food and Stuff. My name is Gretchen Miller.